You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 185 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
Good. I'm finally rested after last week's marathon of, well, being in the office every day for one, and then every night playing a gig 7 nights in a row.
Yeah, it was nice having you. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for keeping the snack machine stocked.
Yep, the kombucha. We have kombucha on tap at CD Baby. That's a little known fact.
That was a surprise.
It's a nice surprise. For those of you listening who don't understand what we're talking about, Chris actually lives in Maine, near Portland, Maine. We, CD Baby, are in Portland, Oregon, and it's very confusing. And but anyway, you were in town at the office for the week, and you also booked a residency at the same venue, Al's Den, that we've talked about in the past. And if anyone listening heard the episode, I forget how many ago, like 10 episodes ago or maybe 7 episodes ago, where it was my keynote from the DIY Musician Conference, I mentioned a previous thing you did at Al's Den, where you did a residency and did some cool things that helped make it interesting and bring people out to the show. So how did you think it went this time?
In terms of turnout, it was about the same. I felt like, and I followed up with the venue to see if they were happy. You know, they said every night was great except Tuesday, which was kind of a slow night, but it's Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday's never good.
Right. In terms of, like, you know, artistically, I thought it was super great. I had a different guest every night, a lot of diversity there. And then I used one night to play 2 hours of entirely new material, which is like something we on this podcast would probably tell people not to do. But hey, you got to come up with gimmicks when you're playing 7 nights in a row. Another one was like all covers. Another one was Harry Nilsson covers. And then like 4 nights I had a band with me. It was fun. A lot of fun.
Yeah. And I came out the last night where you had a band. And I thought, man, this is kind of one of those, I guess, I would use clubs in quotes. It's not a club, is it? What is this place?
I think of it as a listening room attached to a hotel. So there's some, like, you know, touristy hotel people just chancing upon this listening room.
That makes sense. I think listening room, there's a bar, and it's kind of long and narrow and kind of wraps around in the back where there's tables everywhere and people can order some food. But what struck me was this is the kind of place I'd walk into and immediately expect the sound to be terrible because there's no sound guy. It's just a board next to the stage that you kind of have to mix yourself. And the sound was amazing. You guys sounded really great.
Sweet.
And the other thing that struck me is, you know, there were people chit-chatting at some of the tables for the further back you went, but everyone up front was like focused listening. They didn't even have, I don't think I saw one person take a photo or I take that back. One person pulled out the little flyer about you that was on the tables and took a picture of that so they'd remember who you were. But other than that, people were listening. They weren't sitting there videoing. They weren't on their phones, just doing whatever, just, you know, not being in the moment. So that it was very noticeable.
Nice.
You had their attention.
Chris Robley and Al's Den combined for an immersive experience.
That's right. Unlike any other you've experienced. But
well, that's good to hear. I'm glad we... Oh, there's a but.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm glad to hear we sounded good. It's always tough to tell when you're on stage doing your own sound. So that's good to hear.
Yeah, no, it was very impressive. I've been into some touring acts recently where their sound was nowhere near that good. No, it was like the perfect volume. You had a full band, it was a rock band, that it was loud enough to feel the rock without like blowing people away that are just sitting there right in front of you. But it also, you could hear everything. It was just mixed really well. But I was going to say, being who I am, I could not attend without taking some notes.
Oh. All right, lay it on me.
No, I got a lot of notes that I'll give you some separately, but actually there were some observations, not necessarily about you directly, Well, sort of. One was you had mentioned that you had a new release coming out. And you just said a new song. You're releasing a single. And you said, we've got a new single coming out. It'll be out in a couple weeks. And you just kind of left it at that. Which, you know, you probably should have been a little bit more specific.
Bad marketer.
Don't you work on a marketing team? But what it got me thinking was less about that, was more about the idea of have we as artists assumed too much about what people in the audience know and understand about the state of the music business? And by that, I mean, there are so many levels of so many places where people can experience live music and come across a band live. And do they immediately make the connection when they're in this like local listening room environment that, hey, I can just open up my app and find this on Spotify or Apple Music or iTunes? And that's the piece that I was thinking that, you know, I think as artists, we probably assume people know. Consumers know more than they probably do. Had you been playing at a club that it was like a music venue, a known music venue opening for somebody else, I think that connection is more obvious. But I think in these areas, it's like, you sounded amazing. And I was wishing you had told everyone to take out their phones and opened up Spotify and added and followed you, or opened up Apple Music or done, you know, something like that. Cause they all have their phones sitting there.
Well, it's like, oh man, yeah, missed opportunity, because that's totally like, get them to subscribe. You know, I feel like people were attentive. They would have probably picked up their phones and clicked follow if they're already on Spotify. And then as soon as I drop that single, they're getting notified about it.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Chris, you had a point. You had a point in your show where you were having people do barnyard animal noises while you were singing.
Yeah, if they'll do that.
If you got them doing that, after that, you could have easily said, well, now that you've gone to the length of doing barnyard animals, I guess it's okay to ask you to pull out your phone and follow me on Spotify. So you'll be, I mean, come on.
Yeah. Wow.
The other
time machine.
And, you know, because I was like, where's the level where people realize that this music is probably on Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music? You know, when they're walking down the street and they see someone busking on the corner, we all automatically assume that's just some guy busking. We don't necessarily think, oh, I'll go look him up on Spotify. Some people might, but I think the folks in general just kind of think street performer. But where is that level of when they show up and there's music that the perception changes of, this is probably music that I can get? So that's why I think calling that out in those circumstances specifically is probably a good thing. The other thing, you did your whole set. It was an hour long, which is like the perfect length. And there was not one song that I thought, okay, this is kind of a B cut. Everything was great. But the one thing I was thinking was, had you thrown in that kind of situation, like it's a listening room, it's part of a hotel, people come in, it's right next to, you know, Nightlife Central in Portland, Oregon. So it's not like some hotel by the airport or something like that.
The Howard Johnson.
Yeah, it's not the Howard Johnson by the airport. But the other thing is, you had the thing where people, there's a lot of people that are just kind of stumbling in and drifting in. And so I thought, having a cover song closer to the front of the set, where it's strategic to not be like, this is my cool version of this song, but a song that a lot of people would know, that is like a artist that you get compared to a lot, like a sound, Chris sounds like these artists, or an artist that's a big influence that then gives the audience context for how to interpret the rest of the music. Because all your songs are great, but then they know, oh, okay, he's kind of got this Beatles thing going. And if you'd done like something like that, they would then from that point on start filtering everything they hear through that context they now have, how to categorize your music. Because the brain is always trying to categorize everything. And for an unknown artist, or an artist in where you're playing to a lot of folks that probably don't know who you are, they're trying to figure you out song by song. Instead of doing that, like giving them permission, this is what I'm about kind of thing. And then they just enjoy it. So that was some observations.
It's like the welcoming framework up front rather than the massive pop hit that we played at the very end.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We did a pop cover, a very, very pop cover.
which I thought fit perfectly. And I told you you should go write another song like it.
I may have, taken you up on that already.
Oh, well, good. I look forward to hearing that. I've been busy myself. Small Town Poets, we had our 20th anniversary for our debut album. We did a Twitter listening party, which was an fun and interesting experience. Got much better results than I expected. We also did a live YouTube thing. So I'm probably going to put a blog article together about how to host a Twitter listening party, because it's not just about being on Twitter for an hour. It was a lot of work, and I was flying by the seat of my pants the whole time, and I even had a lot of stuff pre-programmed. But that was fun. And
the Twitter party led into the YouTube live conversation, or were they completely separate?
They were kind of separate. I mean, we were all online during the Twitter listening party, and then after that was over, we were on YouTube live to talk about the record. So with the Twitter listening party, we had a whole bunch of things flying the whole time, links to rare videos people hadn't seen, facts about the making of the album, and a bunch of other stuff. So, and every song was, you know, when we started, like we said, hit play now, and I posted a link to the first track, and when that track, you know, I was listening to the whole album down on Spotify at the same time and posting stuff frantically while each song was going. And then when that song was ending, I posted the link to the next one. So the Twitter party lasted pretty much the same length as the album. And a lot of people loved it, got them engaged in the music. And part of the thing I've been trying to do with these things is drive more followers on Spotify and more average monthly users, you know, like, and both of those have gone up about 150 since we've done this and a few other things I've been doing. So
nice.
Been pushing things in the right direction there. Speaking of 20th anniversaries, that brings us sort of a tie in to what we're going to be talking about today.
It does. That's right. I thought you were gonna, it's almost CD Baby's 20th anniversary.
Yeah, next year. Yeah. Next year. So today on the podcast, we are going to be discussing, is your age an obstacle to music success? And we'll be discussing that. I am going to cut out the news section today. We've already talked quite a bit. We've been getting, you know, a few negative Nancys telling us that they don't like how you and I banter at the beginning. Then we have a news section, like, just get to whatever it was titled about. But, you know, this is like a show. This is like, you and I don't get to talk at all ever, so this is like our time.
And we're going to subject you to us catching up.
There's fast forward buttons on podcast listening apps. So we're going to cut out the news. But before we get to our conversation, I want to highly, highly recommend that you stop what you're doing right now. Those of you listening, not you, Chris. And you go to DIYMusicianCon.com and get your ticket for the 2017 DIY Musician Conference happening in Nashville, Tennessee, August 25th through 27th. I cannot give certain details yet because we're still waiting to get things solidified, but you will not want to miss this. For that price, you could waste $69 just going to dinner and a movie. You can get a whole weekend of amazing content, and it's going to be a big party in Nashville. We rented a venue each night. There's more performance opportunities for you as an attendee to submit for. And early bird ticket purchasees. Is that a word? Purchasees?
I don't know.
I don't know. If you buy an early bird ticket, you get advance access to our submission form to submit your music. The conference starts Friday morning in Chicago. Friday was really a half day. Be there, ready to go Friday morning. So that might mean you need to travel Thursday night. But for some things that are in the works, you'll want to be in on Thursday anyway. And so it'll be a full day Friday, full day Saturday, and then Sunday will be similar, like a partial day like we've done in the past.
And for anyone that's listening that's not hearing it, you know, within a week of us posting the episode, the hotel might be sold out, in which case, or those discount block of discounted rooms might be sold out. I've posted an article on the DIY Musician blog that has other hotel options and hostel options and a link to Airbnb and all that stuff. So check that out too, if you want to go a different route for lodging.
Yeah, $69 goes up later this month. Go to DIYMusicianCon.com. So we will see you in Nashville August 25th through 27th. Chris, I probably just got myself another email with someone telling me how long it took us to get to the content.
All right, well, let's launch into it.
Is your music, is your music an obstacle to music? Maybe.
Probably.
Is your age, the official topic is your age an obstacle to music success? So, Chris, why don't you start with the background of why we've been talking about this? I know years ago we did an episode of the podcast titled, Are You Too Old to Make It? But what are we talking about when we say, is your age an obstacle to music success? Why are we discussing age? What's the deal? What's the backstory?
So number one, we're both getting old. that's one factor. But no, what really started me.
I found out you cannot stop that.
Weird. Okay, but what really got me wondering about this is three things. I was remembering back to a tour I did about 7 years ago. I was playing kind of as a side guy, multi-instrumentalist, in this band that really had, like, you know, a name for itself in the Northwest, and somewhat nationally, they toured internationally. And we were on a tour, and they were shopping their new record to labels and considering changing their name. And I was like, that's crazy. You guys are like rock stars in my mind. I'm so happy to be in this band. Why are you going to change your name? And the answer was basically, well, we've been around for more than 10 years and we just need to appear fresh, or, you know, something like that. They didn't end up doing that, thank God. The second thing was, I was remembering back to a time when I got an email from a guy who was starting to have quite a bit of buzz. He was a Portland musician that was doing well in LA, and he was basically coming clean and apologizing to his fan base for lying about his age. I think he was like 35 and he'd been saying he was 28 or something like that. And, you know, it was just about how he felt bad for being dishonest, and but was really under the gun for, you know, appealing to this youth culture thing. And then the third item is one that maybe you would talk about, where a band that had a recent, like, huge hit decided not to draw attention to the fact that they'd been around for like 2 decades.
Yeah, it was a band that I knew back in the day. We started around the same time. And they've had some different iterations of their lineup. Same, you know, couple people had been the same throughout the years. And they had a mild hit, you know, maybe around 1999 or something, that was on rock radio. But recently they've blown up on rock radio. And one of the original members was interested in doing a sort of reunion thing with the original members, and the lead singer was like, that doesn't help us out. That just makes us look old and crusty, kind of thing. You know, it's like, that just draws attention to that we've been around for 20 years when, you know, when you're fans of mainstream rock radio, chances are you're high school, college age. So that really struck me as, like, in their sense, I think it made sense, but maybe not for the reason he gave. I think if you're like having massive success and most people are discovering you for the first time, the last thing you want to say is, hey, the original band was different people. Also, you know, thinking about this topic when you and I were discussing it, I was reflecting on, you know, my experience with small town poets, and just when you're on the road and you're signed to a label and you feel like every success of the next show, whether it's good or bad, might determine whether you get to eat or not. Things, your head just starts to mess with you. And it used to terrify me because we were in the Christian market, and the Christian market did not know how to market to anybody else other than youth groups. And it's like, there are other people on this planet that listen to music that aren't youth groups. But it was like this pre-organized group that typically brought out people to see shows. And so our music was never really intended to cater to that audience. We, to compare ourselves to similar bands that were out at the time, we got compared to Toad the Wet Sprocket, Counting Crows, Gin Blossoms, those kind of bands all the time. And that's more of the college crowd, the, you know, the 20s, the 30s type person. So it was just kind of the idea that as you start getting older, and, you know, I'm talking about going from 22 to 25, you start feeling this very big disconnect from that audience that you're told that, hey, you need to appeal to that audience. It's like that can be very terrifying and feel like if you are no longer relevant to a teenager, that your success is limited. It can really mess with your head. So that also plays into the conversation.
Yeah, well, it kind of leads us to the first question, which I guess we already asked in the title of the episode, but does your age affect the likelihood of success? And I mean, I think it's a very reasonable question because not just the music industry, but the entertainment industry is very obviously focused on youth and beauty and, you know, things like that. And it's strange, but also kind of obvious that the current music industry is very visual based. It's about image and, you know, kind of music plays as an accessory to your life, in a lot of ways. So, listeners are more drawn to what they're being sold visually because really in most instances, they're happy with listening to whatever. It's not this like super deep connection. Maybe I'm painting with a broad brush there, but.
Well, the one thing I would say to that is if you are thinking I'm 50, I want to be a pop icon, and I'm starting my career right now. Let's be honest, that's a long road to, that's a long haul. And not saying it can't, not saying that it's 100% impossibility, but that's a long journey to make that happen. There's a lot of cards stacked against you. But what I take solace in the fact that a lot of that stuff is just fabricated anyway. And I think people listening to this podcast are people that would consider themselves artists. They're not someone that's looking to be a fabrication of a marketing department, which a lot of those pop icons are. And a lot of the people, you know, kind of taking stock in the music I listen to, even bands that I just discovered, like, oh, I found out this band's new this year. A lot of them are older than we think. And it's, you know, a lot of the artists these days are that are at top of mind that people know are in their late 30s, 40s, and some of them even in their 50s. And so it doesn't mean that success can't happen. It just means that I think you have to make some adjustments and realize there's a difference between a fabricated pop icon and how you develop a career over time that the age and growth becomes an asset.
Right. Well, and you know, you said pop stardom is probably not in the cards if you're 50, or you know, it's a lot harder game to win. And there's a lot of examples of artists outside of that pop world who've made it kind of later in life, like Mary Gaucher didn't start writing songs until her mid to late 30s, and Leonard Cohen didn't become like a famous musician until he was, I don't know, 40 or something like that. But again, it's even those are sort of the exceptions to the rule a lot of times when you become, you know, basically what I'm saying is you're probably not going to be a huge rock star anyways, because the cards are stacked against everyone. So
Chris, I am determined to still get to rock star status.
All right, well,
I'm 42, so.
Yeah. So I feel like because the odds are against everyone, then age is maybe even less of a factor to worry about. But yeah.
Well, this podcast, we have a direction with where we're going with what we're talking about. It's not just to depress everybody and make everyone want to get up. That's not what we're going to be discussing. So are we done with part one, or did you?
I just have one more thing to say, and that's to, you know, not to be dismissive of people worrying about their age, because I think there are those perceptions of, oh, if you've put out 10 albums and you still haven't made it, you're probably not very good. You know, that's one prejudice. Or another could be that if you're a young listener and you realize that this person that you are listening to is 40 or something like that, you might think they're you know, they can't relate to what it's like to be 16, or they're out of the loop, or they're not sort of part of your subculture or something. So, and then also a lot of listeners want to be the first to discover something and feel like they're like getting in on something that's new. So anyways, I understand that those are trends and yearnings and questions that are common in the music industry. So with that being said,
well, on the flip side, actually, I think we're going to get there. So let's go to part two. Lead us into part two.
All right. So obviously having an attitude about your age that's defeatist is not good. So what can you do about it? The first thing I always think is that creative maturity takes time, and it's super rare for, you know, someone to be 18 and just arrive as this fully formed genius that's going to write timeless material that speaks to a huge audience. And I personally would way rather hear a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old sing, you know, super subtle, emotional, heart-worn, heartbroken, wise music that, you know. So in terms of what speaks to me, a lot of times it comes with age, which I think is important to remember.
Yes. That's something I noticed with, you know, when I was saying, taking stock and seeing that a lot of the people that I like to listen to, that I've been listening to for years, I want to see that creative growth. I want to see them have something to contribute. You know, once you get out of the high school stage and maybe out of college, you're past the, I just need a piece of candy stage of life. You're like, I need somebody to tell me this is going to be okay, because this is a lot of crap going on. You know, you're kind of in a different stage of life. And I think that for whatever reason, I still can't quite figure it out. I'm not in the mainstream media marketing world, that they still hold that 18 to early 20 demographic so dear. But I'm like, none of those people have money anyway.
They don't have money, right?
Yeah. It's like...
Which is something else we'll get to in this discussion. But
So I think the point... because you said the problem with this attitude is to recognize that your audience may not be teenagers, and that's okay. It may not be somebody the crowd that's going to be the top of pop culture, but that's okay. That doesn't mean that there isn't success there.
Well, and one of the things I wanted to mention was redefining success. You know, if you are thinking about being a major hit and, appealing to that demographic you're speaking about, like, that's one form of success, but so too is having a long sustainable career over 50 years. And if that's what you want, then basically the way I said it in an article I wrote was, don't invest your soul or your art into something that only pays dividends to the young and new, because eventually every one of us is going to be neither one of those things. You know, let your audience grow with you. And I feel hopeful about that, because on the one hand, there's all this talk about how vanity is on the rise, because of economic conditions that are making us feel disempowered in all these other ways. So we take charge of our bodies and our fitness and all that stuff. That is probably true, but I feel like there's also this huge trend towards, like, homegrown, local, sustainable, wellness, all that kind of stuff that I feel like can feed into a healthier attitude about what we expect from musicians.
Yeah, agreed. You skipped over one of the bullet points you had here. I was wondering if you were actually going to mention it.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, let's see. That one. Yeah. The bullet point says, fat, old, bald rock stars in the 70s. There were a lot of them in the 70s. You could be ugly. You could be a brand new act at like 45. You could, have no hair. It was awesome.
Because everyone was stoned in the 70s, Chris.
Right. Well, my next point is, everything is cyclical. So that could be possible again if people would just get more stoned.
You know, I will say that I think... And I will classify myself as an older musician now because I'm 42. So I'm lumping myself into this group. I think one of the things that I've noticed is that my age group and above tend to show up to gigs looking like they just got done working in the yard. Or, you know, that they're not really thinking about an artist persona anymore. And I think it is, and I know it's probably because it's like when you're young and you're like full of, you know, hubris and you just think you're the best and you're never going to die. You're going to live forever and everyone should love you. And when you get older, you get more wise and you realize a few things about the world. You realize you are going to get old. There's nothing you can do to stop it. And some of these things you stop caring about. But I think if you're trying to present an artist persona, that, you know, a little preparation in those areas can help. And it's
a little grooming.
I've had to have those conversations with people in my own band. Like, no, you can't. I know we're old and we've given up on life, but come on, can you at least put a shirt on over that?
I would have loved to have heard those conversations or the responses to your.
They go put a shirt on.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. It seems to be something I've noticed, that a sort of like lack of understanding of the perceptions that might be happening that just feed into stereotypes.
Yeah. So I guess the lesson is, if you've given up on life, don't look like it.
At least don't have dirt stained jeans, unless it's a part of the look, unless
right.
it's like, you know, a cowboy yeah. thing,
a bluegrass band or something. Right.
Yeah.
Well, so let's see, for part three, here's kind of the more, what to do about all this, adjusting your strategies for better outcomes, which, you know, can one person fix this cultural problem we have with youth obsession? No, but there's real specific things you can do in your own music career to kind of minimize the effect of your age on the potential for success. So you want to go first or me?
You go. You set it up. Right. I'm waiting to learn. I'm about to take some notes here.
Well, I know this is your area of passion here. So one thing is using analytics and trending reports to actually know your audience. I mean, I guess backing up, just simply knowing your audience is the real real lesson. But there's a lot of ways to find out who your audience actually is, as opposed to what you maybe think they are or what you wish they were. You can go into your CD Baby account and get a daily report from Apple Music and Spotify and figure out who's actually listening to your music. You know, maybe it's 45-year-old women and not 25-year-old men. So like if you're kind of deluded about who's actually your fans, get smart and look at those tools, and it'll probably end up adjusting a whole lot of things about, you know, the kind of merch you're buying, kind of gigs you're trying to book.
I think, you know, you can use analytics to your advantage in this area. Just like I was saying, when Small Town Poets, when we started working on record number two and going, this is not something for the music we make, is not something a 16-year-old will typically be gravitating towards. We had a lot of fans in that age group, but it wasn't our core demographic, that looking at the scope of who listens to what, that demographic will gravitate towards a band like us. Like I say, more college age, late 20s type of person was really probably our core audience. And so just kind of adjusting and looking and saying, okay, if that's my core audience, what does that core audience need? What do they want? But you don't have to stop there. You can go, this is who my core audience is. Let's build out from here. So let's start here and acknowledge these people and not try, you know, the people that have my attention, that I have their attention, me ignore them and be busy trying to get 18-year-olds to like me. Because that's what I've seen a lot of artists do. And it's like, no, you've got a core audience here. Speak to them. What do they need? What kind of merch do they want to wear? You mentioned analytics. I think when you log into your account, it tells you male, female, it tells you the age range. And if your core audience is 50-year-old women, the kind of merch you might buy and the kind of special experiences and things that you can do to drive extra revenue, whether it be, you know, bundles and things like that might be different than if your core audience is a 30-year-old male. And just looking at that,
And that'll also affect the kind of social media that you use. You know, if again, it's 50-year-old women, you don't need to be on Snapchat. Just ignore that and put your effort into Facebook or, you know, wherever your demographic is. Like, and again, if you're appealing to a younger audience, then be on Instagram and Snapchat and whatever else is cool. But I think there's also a lot of ways of getting data. It's not just, you know, online analytics stuff. Like, just simply looking out at your audience and seeing who is responding to what songs, taking note of who's coming up to your merch table. All of that's kind of just common sense feedback that you're getting that you can, you know, make those adjustments that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think with the Christmas records we did with Small Town Poets, I think one thing that has been interesting to see is that the demographic who love those records definitely skews older, which is great. But it also presents a challenge that same demographic probably isn't going to rush out and buy our next album. So it's interesting, just the idea of like knowing who your audience is and trying to figure that out. And, you know, just I think a lot of it just comes down to being authentic to who you are. There's no hiding, you know, like you said, that artist at the beginning that came out and apologized, he probably felt like he was just, even though it doesn't seem like much, it just seems like, you know, you're living this lie publicly to people that at some point you're going to have to fess up, because at some point they're going to realize this guy is not 25 when he's clearly looks like he's 55.
Right, right. Yeah, eventually it's going to get found out anyways. So.
And then you're just going to hurt your fans' feelings like you think they're idiots or something like that. So that's never the route to go.
I think one important lesson about all this for me was when you change your perspective on what, how do I word this? Sort of when you have this realization about who your actual fans are, as opposed to who you want them to be or who you thought they were, it's not only do you then like get in this mode where you're way more likely to have success, but it's really freeing. Like, so in my life, like when I was 30 or 31, I was really obsessed with playing all the cool like rock clubs in Portland, like places like the Doug Fir and Holocene, which I did play, and you know, like they weren't, you know, terrible shows. Like that was a course that I was taking. And on the side I was doing these solo shows at wineries and at, you know, listening small places where there was an older crowd. When I was playing the clubs, I was trying to appeal to people my age or younger. And I realized at some point, that's not who my audience is. My biggest influences are from maybe a generation older than me or more. So of course my biggest fans are going to be older than me. Of course, like why have I been, you know, pounding my head against the wall trying to be this thing I'm not? And suddenly in my mind, I then became an artist whose primary thing was playing those smaller solo gigs, who then would occasionally branch out and do like a CD release or something at the bigger clubs. It was so, like, I don't know, the creative burden and the pressure you put on yourself to be something you're not, or, you know, totally changed. And then to even have the additional bonus, I realized none of those people had money anyways. Like we said earlier, all these people at these smaller venues are buying merch, they're paying for CDs, they're like older, they have time, their kids are out of school, they're maybe they're retired, which also is last week when I played 7 shows in a row, I had a couple that in their mid-60s that came out to 5 of the 7 shows, and the only reason they didn't come out to the other 2 is because they had to go to the coast. So, like, they came out every single night. Like, that's what older fans can do for you. They have time and energy and money to, you know, support you, so...
Yeah, I think one thing you didn't quite mention in kind of your shift was also, and you and I have talked a lot about this, that booking, when you understand your audience and if you are an artist, use that strategically to your advantage, and that book your shows earlier. You know, nobody wants to be out till 1 a.m. When I see a headliner like going on at midnight or 1, I'm not going to that show. I don't know. It just seems like the That's where college age kids are hanging out. But when I'm planning a show, it's like starting at 9. Let people go eat dinner, have a drink, and then they can come by, and then they're ready to see a show for an hour.
Yeah, I don't even know how much in terms of early shows. Like, I feel like once you're in your early 20s, that's preferable. It's not like it really stops at college age, I feel like. You know, I guess people in their 20s are more likely to stay out later, but even those people don't want to be out that late.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Hello Morning and we were playing a lot of shows in Portland, we actually were trying to trick bigger headliners to play with us so we could play the middle slot, and so we'd get to play to our fans and their fans and go home. Because the headlining slot was always like 11 o'clock or even midnight. I'm like, I don't want to be... I mean, who wants to see a band they've never heard of at midnight?
Not me.
Let's see. A couple more points, then we need to start bringing it home because we've got some calls I've got a hard stopping point. So another
point that I feel like is helpful to mention is that there are community networks out there for all kinds of musicians of all kinds of genres and all kinds of age groups. And I think that's really important to tap into if you are an older musician. So there could be like, local songwriting associations, genre meetups, your music union in your town. And the thing that makes me reminds me of that is that every year I go to this conference called Folk Alliance, and it's a really music-centered thing. It's not about the image, you know, to as much extent as that's possible. And age doesn't seem to be an issue. There's all age groups represented, and they're all showcasing, they're all getting a response, they're all finding opportunities. So these economies can get built up around, the house concert network or touring of listening venues or, things like that. So, another example basically of within that realm, age doesn't matter. And I think also like, you know, a lot of times you think, oh, that blues band that's playing 5 times a week and drawing a huge crowd of like really happy drunks, like probably that crowd is full of like 40 and 50 year olds, like older people, I'm stereotyping here, but you know, when you get to a certain age, like, and you maybe not as interested in discovering the hot new thing, you become loyal to the things that you do respond to. So if you're a blues band and you're all in your mid-60s, like, chances are you'll have a better career than the 20-year-old indie rock guys that are trying to be hip.
I have a theory about that. I have this theory that that people, why people tend to sort of stop listening to new music or start discovering new bands and such. You know, there's all this music when you're a teenager and in college that kind of become soundtracks to some very key and defining moments in your life and also to what's happening in the world around you. And then you go out, you get a job, you get married, you have a family, and you're too darn busy to be thinking about what's the latest band, you know, that I should go check out. And then you kind of come out of this fog when your kids get a little bit older, which I emerged from that fog a couple years ago. And you're like, ah, I've got time again. I've got resources again. Let me dive back into this. And I think a lot of people just sort of like re-engage with the bands they knew from the past because they've been totally out of the loop. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's something to consider that a lot of people that are in their 30s, they've 40s, they've got kids, they haven't really engaged with music culture. They don't even know where to go to find new bands. They're just trying to listen to good music again.
Yeah, and if you could speak to them at their age group where they're at, then been great, because they'll probably be loyal for a long time. Another point, I know we've hammered home this one over the past few months, but as everything's shifting to streaming, it means that music doesn't really ever get old anymore. Like, there's countless ways that a song can be recontextualized or delivered to a new listener without the age of that song mattering at all. So I think that's exciting when you think about lifetime artists that have a catalog, even if you've, you know, not hit it big yet, you still have this huge kind of resume of music that you can present to people as new, because it is to them. It is to anyone that hasn't heard your music.
Yeah.
Which I think is great.
Yeah. And that kind of brings, I'll bring it home with this, because I want to get to the calls, and I think that kind of ties into where I wanted to leave things. But like some questions, I was thinking, are your fans the type of fans that will grow with you? Are you trying to target the right people that will grow with you? Are you growing with your fans? Are you ignoring the fans that have been diehard fans and trying to reengage it with, because they're you feel like they're aging out for you, and you just want to reengage with other fans? I mean, those might be some areas where you're making some mistakes. Ultimately, to me, it comes down to that a good song is a good song. If you write an amazing song that people want to hear, that people want to sing, that people want to listen to over and over again, it doesn't matter how old you are. It can be, it just doesn't matter. The song can transcend any stereotypes of age and youth and all that, and just reach further than you ever imagined. And I think that's kind of like tying into what you said about Spotify, especially now more than ever, that if you want to make it as an artist, no matter how old you are, write great music, get better at writing songs, work with other people, collaborate with other people, and just keep working to write amazing songs. That doesn't matter who or what you are, people have to listen to them.
Yeah, and you know, as people age, they get different responsibilities. Sometimes they get more responsibilities, and it's, you know, not a secret that the older you get, the harder it becomes to go on the road, which is this, you know, presumed the thing that you do to break into a wider audience. But anyways, now there's all these different ways, you know, concert window, live streaming your shows from your couch, podcasts, you know, Facebook Live, you could be a YouTuber. There's all these different ways that you can engage with your audience without having to hit the road, or without having to do the things that might make you shirk your parental or career responsibilities outside of music.
Yeah. All right. Well, if anyone has thoughts or comments, wants to weigh in on the topic of age, has it been an issue for you? Have you had problems getting gigs or breaking through because of it? We want to hear about it. 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or just leave a comment on the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com. But we have some calls. Let's get to them now.
Hey guys, first of all, thank you both for the podcast. I love all the information you put out there in the world. Salute to you and the whole CD Baby team. Much appreciated. My name is Daryl. I go by Great Brilliance on all the socials. But I do a bunch of other stuff, but now I'm thinking about being more serious about my music. I've been a hobby producer for, I don't know, a few years now, but I want to put stuff out there and really get more serious about it. And I just wanted some insight as to, for myself or maybe an artist that I start working with, you know, if we're essentially starting out from scratch, how do we get those first fans? Like, what would you recommend, you know, outside of your family and friends who are already gonna, like, give you that push and, you know, think that you're great? How do you get those first fans that are actually gonna care about your music that you can build a career off of? You know, from a producer standpoint, an artist standpoint, you know, I don't know if you see any differences between the approach, you know, because I'm just focused on instrumental stuff, but I'd love some insight. Thanks again for the podcast, and I hope to hear your response. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks for the call, Daryl. I would suggest, if you're just getting started, the first thing you should do is tap into some other music communities in your area that similar artists, similar people doing some of the things you're doing. That's always a first step to sort of getting access to more people in your area, and even online. Like, the more you know people and start to have opportunities to maybe collaborate, then they start, their fans start hearing your music. That would be, I think, a first place to start, no matter what kind of artist you are. And then for the style of music you're doing, I would definitely see, it sounds like you're doing a lot of instrumental tracks, which that there's big communities of that on SoundCloud, that and SoundCloud's really big with good keywords and metadata that help people find the music, and that type of music is really popular. That's a popular platform for people to share that kind of music.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add to your first point about, you know, getting into a larger community of musicians is don't be afraid early on to work for free or for cheap. If you're doing collaborations, like you want to work with someone who's a little bit ahead of you, like make it worth their, make it an easy decision for them, being like, hey, here's this new instrumental track. What do you want to add anything to it? And then suddenly if people like it, then they're going to know that you're involved with it and come to you for other work.
Yeah. All right. We've got another call. This is from Dave King.
Hi guys. Dave King here, a longtime CD Baby artist. And I was listening to your most recent podcast about things to do to get started. And the name thing is definitely important. I'm a singer, songwriter, solo artist, so I go by my name, Dave King. And I have found there are a lot of Dave Kings out there. And a recent problem I've run into is I've been releasing some songs through CD Baby, and they're hitting Spotify, but they're being attributed to the wrong Dave King. And it's very frustrating that my stuff is being associated with a different artist. I contacted Spotify about this, and they've actually been a little bit helpful in helping me align my name with my songs. But I'm just wondering if you guys have any advice. Is there anything that CD Baby can do to make sure that when the digital distribution happens, that the right songs are going with the right artists as they're being submitted? So that's about it. Great podcast. I always enjoy listening to it. And for all of your listeners, if you can find Dave King on Spotify, I'm wearing a blue shirt with a acoustic guitar against a green door. I need more followers. So go to Spotify and follow me. Dave King on Spotify. Thanks, guys. Bye.
I will acknowledge that what Dave mentions is a problem. It's not specific to CD Baby. It's just something that we're working with Spotify for them to work out on their end and better track all these different artists. We've gone through this with, I think, pretty much every major digital music provider. It used to be a big problem with Apple. They improved their system a lot, so it better recognizes artists so that goes into the right spot and doesn't match them up. But it is going to be a common problem when you have a common name. But if that happens to you, just email us. We can get it fixed for you. But it does take a little work with Spotify for us to get that fixed. So hopefully in the coming days, those issues will be behind us. And just properly attributing data and music and everything is a big issue in the music industry at large, just to be able to handle this so things go where they need to go. So lots of work being done in those areas. We got one last call. I'm going to go ahead and hit play.
Hey, guys. This is Matt from the Second Spirit in Las Vegas. That's my music name. I have a unique question. I have a new album coming out. It's a different genre than what my last album was. It's probably my future albums. Should I head it or subhead it, depicting that it's different than my usual genre? I just thought it was an interesting question, and you guys could help me out. I thought maybe I could put in some keywords or something to subgenre it or to subcategorize it. Maybe I'm thinking too much, too. Maybe I should just release it with a regular title. But anyway, if you guys could have any insight on that, that'd be great. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Chris, what do you think on that one?
So is he asking in the album title to give it a sub? Like, instead of Chris Robley, the Great Make-Believer, it'd be like Chris Robley, the Great Make-Believer Country Folk Pop or something like that?
I don't know, but why don't you just address it from like what you like from a more general perspective of like,
yeah,
I'm an artist. I've kind of got this thing going, maybe that's electronic, and then I get inspired and I kind of do this kind of synthy pop country thing. That's a departure that you know, that may or may not appeal to those same fans.
Okay, so my first instinct is to say, keep it under your name and keep all of your catalog under one artist name, even if it diverges from what you're known for, because eventually someone like Elvis Costello or David Bowie, eventually they become known for the diversity and it's part of their brand. And you might regret down the road, if you change the band name or something like that to, for these one-off projects, you might regret the, that they're not all folded under one umbrella or whatever. That being said, I don't know how wildly it diverges from what you usually do.
Yeah. It's hard to know without hearing it.
And, you know, I guess if the album cover and the title of the album, hint at the departure, you know, I know Joe Jackson was kind of doing a new wave thing in the 70s, and then the early 80s, he did this big band swing album. And I think, I forget exactly what it was called, but it hinted that it was a departure and that it was a different genre involved in the title. But ultimately, looking back, it still sounds like him. It's his voice, it's his sensibility applied to a different genre. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Like, it might not diverge as wildly as you think if you're still the kind of controlling force behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point about how artists will do some things like a big band thing or something with an orchestra or something that is different, but it's still them. And sometimes it's a nice departure. Sometimes the fans like it. Sometimes they're like, oh, this is cool. They sort of tip their hat to a different genre that they are a part of or that they like, but may not be a part of their normal experience. And now I get to enjoy them, understand the breadth of their music artistry better. So that's one thing that could be interesting. But, you know, if it's something like where you're going to do a totally different thing, like you're going to go on tour as a kind of a different persona altogether, then to me, that might be different. Maybe that's what it comes down to, the persona. If you're changing the persona of who you are, then maybe that's where you do something different. But if it's like you're keeping the same persona, it's just you did different music, if it's just a one-off, and I mean, I would say what Chris says and keep it under your name, but you might title it in a way that gives some indication that what you're about to hear is different. Just title your album what you're about to hear is different.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think another thing that happens is you think it's a one-off, right? You think you're going in this new way, but that might be what the next one's like too. Or you have this one departure and then two or three albums later, you do a completely different genre. And so, you know, like you don't want to come up with a new band name and a new social media page and website for every single little departure you do.
True. So. All the good band names are taken anyway, so you might as well use your name. All right. Well, I hope that helps, Matt. Thanks for all the calls. Again, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 if you've got a question you want answered on the show or a comment or feedback or anything, or a success story, or a story about how your age was used to your advantage or hindered success in your music. We'd love to hear about it.
If you found the fountain of youth, we'd love to hear about it.
Yes, because I'm 42 and my hair's starting to get a little thin, Chris, and I can't stop it. I can't stop it. But I can stay thin, like you said. I can control that.
You can control that, yes.
So, all right. Well, again, I want to remind you to go to DIYMusicianCon.com, get your early bird ticket at $69. You will not believe the amount of cool stuff and great information you'll get for that price. You won't get it anywhere else. And book your hotel room. Make sure you show up ready to go Friday morning, August 25th. And I said it kind of as a half day on Sunday, but actually Sunday, we've got some plans. There might be some late afternoon activities. And then we've got the Sunday night closeout big party, two floors, two stages on Broadway in Nashville. It's just going to be an amazing time. And I get to be paid to be there.
Do I get paid to be there?
Yes, I do. Yes, you do. And, we're, I say that I get to be paid to be there, but I only have to do about 1,000 hours of work in order to be paid to be there. So,
right. So,
all right. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the podcast. We'll catch you later. Bye.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.